So, welcome to lesson two of the world of Kabbalah, the dawn of limitation. It's great to be back, and great to see everyone, and we're in for an exciting class tonight. We are going to open once again, as we did last week, with a chapter of Psalms, a prayer to God Almighty, which I'll recite, a short one that I'll recite on behalf of everybody here. And we'll keep in mind our brothers and sisters in the Holy Land of Israel. Specifically, we'll pray for all the hostages to come home safe and sound to their loved ones and their families. And for all the members of the IDF for their safety and security and for success in their mission. Shir HaMaalis to David, Samachti Ba'emrim Li Beis Adinoi Nelech, Oimdeis Hayu Raglenu B'Shurayich Yerushalayim Yerushalayim Habnuya, Kiir Shechubra Lo Yachtav Shesham Alu Shvatim Shivteya Eidus Yisrael LaHaydeis Hashem Adinoi, Kishama Yashvu Kisois LeMishpat Kisois LeVid David Shadu Shloim Yerushalayim Mishloyu Oyavayach, Yehi Shalom Becheilech Shalva Ba'armane Soyech Lemanachai Virei Adabra Nashalim Bachelman Beis Adonai Eloheinu Avaksha Tov Lach. So, of course, saying a prayer here, in fact, here we're all together, but even if you do so at home, whenever you have a few extra moments, reciting a chapter or chapters of Psalms goes a long way in sending spiritual support that they need. And we're all one body, we're all one unit, and what we do over here is felt over there. So any mitzvah that you do is a very powerful love package that we send them, and with God's help, we'll see the fulfillment of all of our prayers. So, if anyone needs, there are pens up here. There's also pads of paper, which doesn't seem like they're in high demand, but they're available if necessary. If you didn't get a book yet, I also have over here. Okay. So Albert Einstein was taking a train from Princeton to somewhere, and he was in a seat, and the conductor started to come by to ask for tickets to punch the ticket. And he approaches Dr. Einstein and asks for his ticket, and he starts to feel in his jacket pockets. Then on the side, his pants pocket, couldn't find it. He didn't know what to do. The conductor said, "Dr. Einstein, I know who you are. I know you bought a ticket. Don't worry about it. No big deal." And continues on his way. Before he's about to leave this car and go to the next one, he turns around and looks back, and he sees Dr. Einstein is on his hands and his knees looking for his ticket under his seat. So he goes back to him and he says, "Dr. Einstein, I meant what I said. It's really okay. I believe you. You have a ticket." He said, "You don't understand. I appreciate that, but I have to find out where I'm going." So on this course, which we launched last Monday, it's a very unique opportunity that we have in this course. First of all, we're going to find out where we are and where we're going. And we're, you may have had other opportunities to study ideas, Kabbalistic ideas, but what's unique here is that we're exploring six big ideas, or six of the most fundamental ideas within Kabbalah, but more importantly, that we're doing so in a way that's relatable to every single one of us, in a logical way. And after this course, you should definitely feel like you achieved a great deal and long on your way to becoming a trained Jewish mystic. So last week, we talked about, anyone remember? Three worlds. Three worlds? Yes, the three. I'm not sure about the big three. Maybe as of now, they're the big three. But by the end of tonight, they may not be so big after all. But yes, the three worlds, we called them Bia as an acronym for Bria, Yetzira, Asiya. And then we also talked about how they correlate with thought, speech, and action, and how they are how they reflect our own garments, just like the garments of our soul are independent of our soul. So too, these three worlds are independent of God. And it's where the beginning of creation actually is. And these three worlds, even in the first of the three, called Bria, already, so to speak, feels itself. It's the beginning of self-awareness and having a self-concept. You may recall we talked about the analogy of the parent raising a child. The more that the parent withdraws and creates space for the child, the more the child becomes independent. So similarly with these three worlds, because God withdraws his energy and his presence, that allows for the worlds to emerge, eventually the world that we inhabit, this world where we have a physical world, where we have beings and creations in this world that actually could convince themselves they can deny God or reject God. That's how withdrawn God is. Imagine a parent who's so withdrawn that of an adult child, that they can convince themselves that they're totally independent and no one ever did anything for them in their life. So that's the world that we live in. But that was just to sum up very briefly the three worlds that we discussed last week. So today we're going to advance, and it's going to be an exciting class. We have a lot to cover, so we're going to try to cover as much as we can in the amount of time that we have. And we're going to open with a wonderful Hasidic story on page 38 in your student book. And I need Nanette, I'm going to ask you to read that story for me, please. It's a little bit of a longer reading, but take it away. It's going to bring us into our topic today. Text number one on page 38.
Lost souls. A wealthy businessman and his coachman arrived in a city one Friday afternoon. The rich man was settled at the best hotel in town, and the coachman went off to his humble lodgings. Both washed and dressed for Shabbos, and then set out for the synagogue for evening prayers. On his way to shul, the businessman came across a large wagon that had swerved off the road and was stuck in a ditch. Rushing to help a fellow in need, the businessman climbed down into the ditch and began pushing and pulling at the wagon together with its hapless driver. But for all his finesse at handling the most challenging of business deals when it came to extracting a wagon and a team of horses from a muddy ditch, our businessman was hopelessly out of his depth. After struggling for an hour in the knee-deep mud, he succeeded only in ruining his best suit of Shabbos clothes, amassing a most impressive collection of cuts and bruises, and getting the wagon even more impossibly embedded in the mud. Finally, he dragged his limping body to the synagogue, arriving a scant minute before the start of Shabbos. Meanwhile, the coachman arrived early to the synagogue and sat down to recite a few chapters of Psalms. At the synagogue, he found a group of wandering paupers, and, being blessed with a most generous nature, the coachman invited them all to share his Shabbos meal. When the synagogue sexton approached the poor and homeless to arrange meal placements for them with the town's householders, as is customary in Jewish communities, he received the same reply from all of them: "Thank you, but I've already been invited for the Shabbos meal." Unfortunately, however, the coachman's budget was hardly equal to his generous heart. It would be most difficult to believe that his dozen guests left his table with more than a shadow of a meal in their hungry stomachs. Thus, the coachman, with his 20 years of experience in pulling wagons out of mud holes, took it upon himself to feed a small army, while the wealthy businessman, whose Shabbos meal leftovers could only have fed every hungry man 10-mile radius, floundered about in a ditch. Rabbi Yosef Yitzhak of Lubavitch told this story and explained its lessons. Every soul is entrusted with a mission unique to her alone and is granted the specific aptitudes, talents, and resources necessary to excel in her ordinary role, ordained role. One must take care not to become one of those lost souls who wander haplessly through life, trying their hand at every field of endeavor, except for what is truly and inherently their own.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. So, what happened in this story? Each one tried to do a mitzvah, an important mitzvah indeed, but each one tried to do something that was intended for the other one. This rich fellow was trying to pull a horse and wagon out of a ditch. He wasn't cut out for it. It didn't really go well. And the poor fellow was inviting guests over to his house for dinner, which, although it was well intended, but he couldn't really cater to the needs of those guests. So it's true in the lives of all of us. In our own lives, sometimes there are certain opportunities that come our way that we are meant to get involved in. They're cut out for us. It's a mitzvah that's intended for us, for our soul. But sometimes things come our way and they're not really intended for us. They're really more cut out for somebody else, because I won't be able to do what's necessary. I won't do a good job at it. It won't get done. Meaning, we shouldn't use this ever as an excuse to say no to something, but meaning unless we really will fall short. But as long as it could be done a lot better by someone else, then we should try to arrange, like that rich fellow, he should have paid for somebody, for someone else to go pull the wagon out of the ditch. So we should do what it takes for it to get done, but maybe through somebody else. So the question is, how do we know what is cut out for us and what isn't? That's really the question. Is it time to retire from my job and get involved in something else? Or maybe not. Maybe I still should be making a difference in the same work I was doing until now. So maybe I should I take up an invitation to join my synagogue board? Or maybe I should be involved in Israel advocacy. Who knows? There's a lot of different things, a lot of different opportunities, and sometimes we're not sure which one is ours. So to be sure, many people go about things based on what feels right. Well, this makes me feel good. That doesn't make me feel so good. So I'm going to go with what makes me feel good. Now, that's not terrible, but that's not the only thing that we should think about when we are considering what we should be devoting ourselves to or committing ourselves to. Because it's not just about what makes me feel good, it's about what am I needed for. What does God have in mind for me? What's the Almighty's plan for me and my life's mission? That's the question we need to be asking ourselves. But ultimately, the question is, how do we know? How do we figure out what it is? So, remember this question. Hold the thought. We're going to revisit it in a little while. But first, we're going to get into the meat of tonight's discussion. Okay, so far, so good. There are times to act and times to refrain. How do we tell them apart? So, as I mentioned, we just talked about last week where we discussed the garments of the soul. You may want to take out the course map if you have access to it, if you have it handy, and take a look at where we are, so that we'll know where we are in the map, so we don't get lost like Dr. Einstein. Just going to add this slide to our discussion. You know, there are certain factors that come into play when we are trying to decide what our life is cut out for or what our mission is. Sometimes family history would be an indicator. Education that we got, the environment we grew up in, the greatest communal need at the moment, that should impact our decision, something that we enjoy or something that we are good at. So any of these factors should be considered when deciding what we are cut out for. Okay, so back to the map. We, generally speaking, we're talking about powers and garments of the soul. On the map in general, and this line kind of combines lesson one and lesson two. Powers and garments of the soul. Last week, we spoke about the soul garments of thought, speech, and action. But today, We're going to be advancing, as I think I mentioned last week, that we are starting from the bottom. Why are we starting from the bottom? Because that's what's closest to us. That's what we most relate to. That's what we have access to. We know more than everything else. So that's where we're starting from. From what's most relatable. We spoke about the garments of the soul. But now we're going to move upward. Hello, Anna. And we are going on to from the soul garments, we're moving up to the soul powers. And these, in Kabbalistic jargon, are called kochot hanefesh, as you'll see in the terms, one of the terms that we'll be learning. And the meaning of that is soul powers. The soul's 10 attributes that are broadly divided into two categories, intellect, otherwise known as seichel, abyssal seichel, right? And emotion, which is midot in Hebrew. Midot meaning emotions. So we're moving up, okay, keep that in mind. We're moving from garments. We're moving up to soul powers today. And I hope you got that on your map. So what's this idea of soul powers? So we talked last week. We actually learned a word last week. Anyone remember the word for the whole system? Hishtal-shelut. Hishtal-shelut. Hishtal-shelut means like a chain. That's the root of the word, shalshelet, but it refers to the whole dynamic, sophisticated process from God until this world that we know of. It's all called Seder Hishtal Shalut. So we started from the bottom, but now we're going to be talking about the 10 soul powers. We also said last week how we have to look at ourselves in order to discover God. We quoted a verse from Job, Mibsari, Echaze Eloka. We have to look at our own flesh to discover and identify God. And we're created in His image, I'll remind you. So therefore, it's appropriate to look at ourselves to get to know God. So here too, we're going to talk about these soul powers that every one of us have. At the same time, we're going to discover how these 10 soul powers are actually a reflection of the 10 attributes or 10 divine attributes, which we'll be learning a lot about tonight. All right, so I'm going to introduce you to yet a new world, okay? Last week we spoke about three worlds, BIA, the acronym, but today we're going to climb even higher. We're going to go from the three, and we're going to climb up to a new world that's called Atzilut. Can everyone say that? It's an important word tonight. Atzilut, or Atzilus in the Ashkenazi pronunciation. Atzilut in the more Sephardic. And we'll learn a lot about this world. And we're saying higher, remember. Higher doesn't mean that it's taller, or that it's placed higher somewhere on a map, even though on a map it is higher, because that's the only way we can understand it. But it means higher in rank, in stature, and in spirituality, as we'll be learning soon. So we're going to learn about this world, Atzilut, and in fact, we're going to learn about the 10 powers within this world. Okay? We're going to be learning a lot of deep ideas tonight. It's all going to make sense in the end. But feel free to ask questions if it's necessary and you can't kind of advance without that question. Definitely just raise your hand and we'll try to address it. But hopefully things will become clearer and clearer as we proceed. Yes?
So the soul powers is on the left side, Keter, Hakma, Bina, Dot, Gemara, Kesed.
Yes, those are all part of the 10, exactly. Those are part of the 10 soul powers. So, all right, let's move along here. I'm sure you're familiar with the concept of avoiding to recite God's name, right? Like in its full glory. We don't say God's name. We don't even write it out. I mean, if it's in a prayer book, you'll find it. But if we're just writing, we don't even write God's name fully. In fact, even in English, instead of G-O-D, you'll find G-D in many cases. And the reason for that is because of the reverence that we have for God's name and what it represents. And out of respect, we don't just write it out just like that. So, fascinatingly, we find that a great mystic known as the Alter Rebbe, the author of the Tanya, Rabbi Schneer Zalman, we're going to have this short reading here in text number 2. Michael, if you could please read that for us, something about the Alter Rebbe's relationship with this world of Atzilut. Text 2, please, 41.
Used to refer to Atzilut as above. It is said that because of intense emotion when writing the word, he could get no further than Atzi.
So, essentially, it's not like one of God's names. It's just a, it's a world. Now, it's a super divine world. It's not a physical world like ours. But just imagine, because he was a mystic, and he was a servant of God, and to him, the world of Atzilut was very real. It wasn't just a topic of discussion. It was a world that maybe he even visited now and then. He certainly had a concept of how intensely, overwhelmingly spiritual that world is. And as a result, when he wrote about it, which he did often in his writings, you could study it today, he never was able to write more than the first three letters of the word. Aleph, Tzadik, Yud, and then Dash. And that the reason for that is because it's a purely divine world. Again, I'm going to continuously make the distinction between Atzilut, which we're discussing today, and the three worlds we discussed last week. Because the three we discussed last week, even in the highest of the three, that is where independence was introduced. Even in the highest world of Bria, there was self-awareness already. Think of the child the child may be an infant and maybe is very dependent on the parent, but there's already a measure of self-awareness. That is in what we discussed last week. Introducing the new world of Atzilut, there's absolutely no self-awareness. There's no independence there at all. It's all God, exclusively, overwhelmingly. And a mystic like Rabbi Schneer Zalman was aware of that. He experienced it. And because of that, he wasn't even able to write out the word fully. And therefore had this like intense reverence for it, almost like as if it was one of God's names. So, with that in mind, let's begin. We're going to take a step forward. And here's a big question. We're actually going to pose a contradiction here. And that goes like this. Let me just ask you first. Who thinks, could you say about God that God is kind? I'm not getting into kind or not kind. I mean applying any attribute to God. Can you say that God is compassionate? Can you say that God is strict or judges or whatever? Can you apply any of these terms? I don't mean one versus the other. I mean, could you apply any of these terms to God? Yes. 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 Okay. Well, it depends. Anyone say that you can't? Okay. We have some no's also. And as I'm sure I've shared the story before, a couple came to the rabbi and they were having this little skirmish. And first the wife said her story, and the rabbi says, you know what, you're right. Then the husband speaks and says his story, and he says, you know what, you're also right. So the rabbi's wife chimes in from the kitchen and says, my dear husband, how could they both be right? And he says, you're also right. So you're both right. But now let's get into it. So we have this contradiction here. We have various different verses in the Torah that will speak of each side of this debate. So we have to figure out which one is going to be correct. So, Leah, would you like to read for us text number 3 and then 4? Please read both of them. The first one is a verse from Proverbs, the second from Chronicles. Go ahead. In English.
God with wisdom founded the earth, with understanding established the heavens, with his knowledge the depths were split.
Over to 4.
unto you, God, his greatness and power and beauty and triumph and splendor, for all in heaven and on earth unto you.
So, thank you very much for both. So what do we have here? Two verses that clearly identify God with these specific traits. God is great, God has power, beauty, triumph, splendor, etc. So it seems like one side of the debate, very clearly, verses in the Torah are identifying God with specific traits. Okay, but that's only one side of it. But then we have another side of it in text number 5. Kim, would you like to please read that one for us? This comes from Rabbi Yehuda Lowy, known as the Maharal of Prague.
The ultimate abstract simplicity.
Thank you. So this is the other side of the coin, right? I'm sure you've heard God being referred to as HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He. When you hear holy, what does holy mean? What do you think about when something is identified as holy? Just call out.
Sacred.
Godly, sacred, pure. Anything else? Everyone agrees, I guess. So, yes. But what does the word literally mean? The word kadosh actually means like separated and designated, removed, lofty, or transcendent. That's what kadosh means. It's like marriage in Hebrew is called kiddushin, because you become designated. You start belonging to one and you're removed from everybody else. That's where it comes from. And that's what kiddush, to sanctify, means. This day of Shabbat is holy, it's designated. That's what kadosh means. So we refer to God as kadosh. In God's case, it highlights the fact that God is totally transcendent and removed. In Hebrew, we use the word pashut or pshitut, which means, literally would mean simplicity, but we don't mean simple as simple. We mean simple as undefined when we talk about God. So on one end, we have these verses where God is identified. We have this contradiction. Is God the transcendent one who is free of attributes, which HaKadosh would mean? Or is he the immanent one who bears specific praiseworthy attributes? So which is he? Can you say that God is, to him, is greatness, power, beauty, etc.? Or is God just undefined and beyond it all? So we have this contradiction in Jewish sources. And what's the answer? They're both right. Depends what you're talking about. Depends on what level. But we'll see shortly how we answer this question. Yes.
I went under the impression that God cannot be defined by human terms.
You're right. You're absolutely right. And that's what we just said from the Maharal of Prague, that God cannot be defined with any specific attributes, certainly not in ones that we apply to humans only.
So
but
why we say that you have to look at yourself to see God?
Wonderful, because there's another side to it. There's another side to it, and because we do have these 10 soul powers, we're going to discover that God also does. But the question is, how do these two things coexist? How do we reconcile, on one hand, He's transcendent and undefined, and on the other, he does have these various different definitions. So the answer is going to come in the form of a parable, which is discussed heavily in the Hasidic philosophy, which of course is all a commentary on Kabbalistic works. And this parable is used a lot in various different ways. We're going to introduce it right now. Okay, so here we are. So say, for example, you have this brilliant professor by the name of Isaac Newton. Okay, Newton. And let's say He walks into a high school, and he wants to convey to teenagers some big theory that he has, that he's come up with. So he realizes right away that there's no way that the teenagers are going to relate to his brilliant theories. So he says, you know what? I'll let them ask me questions instead, or I'll talk about my youth. I'll talk about what brought me to explore the area that I study or that I'm into. But then realizes, well, if I do that, then they're not going to be getting anything that I stand for. That's not what they need me for. Anybody can come talk about their life. I want to really give and deliver one of my ideas. But to teenagers, that's kind of impossible. There's an unbridgeable gap here. So what does he do? So Dr. Newton, if you will, if he went by that title, steps back and he says, you know what, let me think about this. And he thinks really long and hard. And he identifies some idea within his theory that he kind of like modifies and distills in a way that he was able to extract an idea from his big theories that he is now going to be able to present to these teenagers. Okay? So now, the question now is, in this parable that we have now, we actually have two different levels to Newton. We have Newton the way he is by default, the way he is just for himself. Before he walked into that high school, Newton and his theories are totally removed from the realm of these teenagers. They're incapable of relating to it whatsoever. That's component one or dimension one of Newton. But then you have Newton, the way he took some of his ideas and processed them, reduced them and modified them, and created a version that should be relatable to the students. So here's the question. The second level, level number two of Newton, the idea that he did distill and modify that the teenagers could now relate to, is that second level inferior to the first?
No.
Well, it is inferior because it's not the full intensity of his brilliant theory. It is processed and distilled and something that only that these teenagers are now able to relate to. So it is inferior. But, in other words, to Newton as he is, they would never be able to relate. So he needed to do this. He needed to do this distilling. And it is reduced, on one hand. Nevertheless, we have to remember that he didn't come up with a new childish idea to talk to these teenagers about. He took his original idea and processed it and distilled it, and eventually now the teenagers are able to relate to it. So on one hand, it's certainly inferior. It's not the full intensity of his theory, but at the same time, it is of his theory. It's not a new idea that he came up with just to be able to satisfy these teenagers with something, to talk about something for an hour, to keep them busy and happy, and then move along. It actually was of his brilliant theory that it was in the first place. Am I making sense here at all? Yes? Okay, so we have two levels here. And the point that we're making so far is that on one hand, it is inferior. On the other hand, it is of his idea. It is Newtonian. Even what he's giving the teenager is still Newtonian. It's not a foreign idea or something new that's detached that he just came up with to give them. It is of his original idea. Okay? In other words, his original theory actually had this that he's actually giving to the teenagers. His big original theory actually had that idea within it, in its pre-existing potential. It was already there. It's just that he had to really think long and hard of how I can make sense of this to these teenagers. when he did put in the work, then he came up with it. But it was already part of the original idea from the get-go and potential. Is everyone good? Okay, so this is the parable. This is the parable that's discussed a lot, the relationship between teacher and student, the teacher the way he is for himself, and then the teacher the way he comes up with an idea from his ideas, but processed in a way that a lower level student could now relate to him. Good? All right. So with that, let's go to text number 6, straight out of the Zohar. Jacob, would you like to read that one for us, please?
You are one, but not in the numerical sense. You are exalted above all the exalted ones, hidden from all the hidden ones, who no thought can grasp you whatsoever. You are the one who has brought forth 10 ornaments, which we should call spirit, to direct concealed worlds and revealed worlds.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Last week, I remember before we started, I asked for, when you think Kabbalah, what word comes to mind? Somebody here said Sephiroth.
That was me.
Certainly you. Maybe it was even more than one, but certainly Lou. Sephiroth. What are these Sephiroth? So we're introducing them here. The Sephiroth actually are primarily in this world that we're discussing tonight, called Atzilut. This is where we have these 10 Sephiroth. Now, we just read in text number 6 from the Zohar that on one hand, we say that God is one, and he's exalted above all exalted ones, etc. Then the second half of that text that we just read, that Jacob read, we say that you are the one who has brought forth 10 ornaments, which we call the 10 Sephiroth. So there is God, the way he is, one above all else, and beyond any description and undefined. But then God also brought forth these 10 Sephiroth. And what are these exactly? What are these 10 Sephiroth? So God is above all else. He's the one and only. He's undefined and on anything, and you can't attribute anything to him. But then suddenly he has these 10 Sephiroth. So what does this mean? Give me a second, please. So we have two truths here. On one hand, we have God, and God is transcendent, attributeless and ungraspable. And, as we called him before, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he's beyond, he's transcendent. But at the same time, we also have God ornaments himself with 10 definable and limited attributes. So God is doing both. He transcends, but then he also takes on this manifestation of 10 different characteristics. Okay? So, this, we can already, we can just think back to the parable about Newton, right? So there was Newton, the way he was, totally beyond, the way he is, as he is, and those teenagers in that school would have no way to relate to him because he's totally above anything they can grasp. But then that same Newton thought long and hard of how can I actually deliver some of my goods to those teenagers? And when he put in the work, he actually was able to take something of his idea and distill it for them. And this helps us understand how it works within this world of Atzilut. So on one hand, you have God, the way he transcends. And by the way, this is not Atzilut. God transcending is God, the way he is infinite, which we're going to discuss more at length next week. Next week's topic is infinity. Now, today, we're not exploring infinity, but we're just trying to create the contrast. We're saying that the world of Atzilut, which is tonight's topic, is not God the way he is infinite and transcends and undefined and attributeless. That's the way he is infinite, which we're going to discuss more next week. Today we want to understand what is the world of Atzilut and what are these 10 manifestations. So far what we said is that just like that professor distilled his idea to be able to deliver something to a young student, so God manifests himself within these 10 characteristics. So even though he was infinite and beyond and transcendent, he takes on this front, let's just say, and manifests himself within these 10 powers. Okay? Yes.
So, using your analogy here, number two is the Sephirot, right? So, like the entry point, the Newton explanation is the Sephirot for us to understand. And the two truths can be true even over time, right? I can start with number two, and as I become more educated or enlightened or empowered, eventually I will reach number one.
Next Monday. Yes. So, yes, you're right. I mean, when it comes to a professor, so with time, eventually, we mature and we'll eventually, meaning our understanding will mature and develop, and we'll then understand their original ideas. When it comes to God, there's God the way He is beyond, then there's God the way He manifests Himself within the world of Atzilut with these 10 characteristics. So let's advance. There's more coming. This is just introducing the idea. So it's very important to realize that just like we said, that the idea that the professor gave to the young students are not new, but they're of his original idea, it's very important to remember that about God too. We can never separate God's attributes from Himself and say that these are not Him. That's a no-no in Judaism. We can't identify anything as godly that isn't totally God Himself. I'm not going to get into it heavily right now, but there's actually a debate among philosophers and Kabbalists of what exactly these ten characteristics are. Just for a little bit of fun, just to tease you, one opinion says that you can't call God kind. You can't say God is kind, because then you're giving a definition to God, and you can't do that. But what about the fact that God does acts of kindness? When God gives life to the world, He's being kind. So why can't I say that God is kind? So that opinion will say that God, it's not that God is kind. It's just that right now He's acting kind. But when He finishes acting kind, there's no attribute left of it. He did it, and now you can't say He is kind anymore. It's just God. That's one opinion, one position. Make sense? Another position is that just like a handyman comes to your house, or a plumber comes to your house, and he's carrying a suitcase of tools. So God has a tool set, and one of His tools is kindness, another one is compassion, another one is beauty, splendor, power, greatness, whatever. These are just tools, they're not God. You can't say God is any of these things. He uses it. As soon as He's done, He puts it back in the tool shed, and that's it, and moves along. But the Kabbalists actually reject both of those positions. We're going with a third position because we're studying Kabbalah. And the reason why they reject it is because the verse that we quoted before says that God is kind. And this is the Torah itself saying it about God. So we don't have a problem with saying that God is kind. We don't need to say that it's just a tool in the toolbox, but it's not really Him. The verse says it's Him. So we still have to understand what that means. But we don't have a problem with saying that God is kind. Yes, there's also God the way He transcends, but then there's also God the way He manifests Himself within these 10 attributes. And let's go on to a fascinating illustration here, okay? So, first we have this term called Sephirot, 10 specific definable attributes that God manifested from His infinite self. Okay? I hope I'm clear. If I'm not, please speak up because it's going to get even more fun. Okay. Pay attention here. This is, we're doing a little exercise. So you see a sheet of paper here, right? Forget about the fact that it's on a screen. From here starts a sheet of paper. And somebody's about to write on this paper. Okay? So, what does it say on the paper? Sphirot. But what? How did that? How are we reading that on this paper? Right? Any of you that are holding a pen in your hand and you just wrote something on your paper, what's the relationship between the ink and the paper? Are they one or are they two different things?
Two different.
They're two different things. This was ink, was independent, and then there's a paper, and now with the ink, I write down this word on the paper. Yes, now it's on the paper, it's very hard to get it off,
But it's still two separate entities that came together. That's what just happened when that hand wrote that word on this sheet of paper. Okay? Two different things. But now we're going to do something else. There's another option of how to get that word to emerge or to be displayed on this paper. And this is what we're doing now. So we just took a black sheet of paper. Okay, imagine this black sheet of paper had the word Sefirot cut out of it. Not written on it. It's a black sheet of paper. And we cut out an S-E-F-I-R-O-T. And then we pick it up and put it in front of the white paper. Following? We had a white sheet of paper, separate black sheet of paper with the word Sefirot cut out within it. And then we picked up the black piece of paper and put it in front of the clean white sheet of paper. There was nothing on the white. The black doesn't have anything written on it. It just has these letters cut out. And we put it in front of the white. Now, these white letters, what are they?
You can't see them anymore.
These white letters, is it ink that was attached to the paper?
No.
It's white. No. It is actually emanating from the white sheet of paper. It's not a separate entity. When I wrote on the paper, it was another entity being attached to the sheet. Now I picked up the black sheet, which just had this cut out within it, and it's the white sheet of paper that's emanating through it. So what's happening here? When we talk about God and the 10 attributes, let's not ever think that these 10 powers or 10 characteristics are outside of God by any measure. They are emanating from God. Okay? They're totally Him. Remember what we said in the parable, that the idea that's being delivered to the teenagers is not a new idea. It's not a separate idea that He came up with in order to relate to them. It was an extension and a distillation of His original idea. It's just more processed so that He can now make it relatable to them. Here too, when we talk about these 10 characteristics, it's God Himself. It's emanating from God. Okay? So, let's just read text 9b, which we'll just, you know what, where are we, Jacob? Jacob 2. How about just read 9a and 9b, please.
The first of the Sefirot, Chokhmah, cannot be termed a creation, God forbid, because it is literal godliness. Rather, God condenses His light to the extent that He can manifest Himself in Chokhmah and the other attributes. The intellectual attributes are His attributes. The kindness is His kindness, and so forth.
Keep going, one more. 9b.
The Sefirot are called Atzilut, not Boreah. The term Atzilut in the Torah, Numbers 11:25, means emanation, which indicates that the Sefirot are an emanation from God's infinity, not an independent creation. This provides us with a second reason for referring to the Sefirot as Atzilut. From the etymological root Etzel, meaning together with God.
Thank you. So the word Atzilut means together with or near. So again, just to highlight this point, last week, once we talk about the world of Bria, we wouldn't be using this analogy or this experiment or exercise, because the world of Bria is not only an emanation from God Himself. The world of Bria is actually an independent entity. The three worlds we discussed last week, like the three garments of the soul, they're independent from God. They already have a measure of self-awareness, and they have a measure of independence. Once we advance to this world of Atzilut, it is overwhelmingly God exclusively, and it's just an emanation from Him. It's not something else. It's not an independent creation. It's just an expression or an emanation or a manifestation of God Himself. Okay. Are we good? Yes, Lou.
Can I come back to the two descriptions of the word sphirot on the paper?
Mm-hmm.
Or cut out of the paper. So one is the ink is on the paper. The other is it's cut out of the paper. But there's a third. Because there are some inks and some papers in which the ink goes into the paper and is not just on top, and it becomes one.
But it still started as two independent, two separate entities that became attached. So, say, for example, when you talk about the connection between a Jew and Torah, so a rabbi once suggested that every Jew represents a letter in the Torah, and a letter in the Torah is ink on parchment, right? Later, when I don't want to get into the story, but a rabbi shared this idea when he traveled from New York to Chicago. This is in the 40s. He came back to New York, shared with Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak what he said. He said, if I would have been giving the speech, I wouldn't have said that a Jew is like a letter in the Torah, because a letter in the Torah is ink on parchment. Those are two separate entities.
And the ink doesn't go into the parchment.
And even if it's now attached, it still started as two separate entities. A Jew and Torah is not even that. A Jew and the Torah is like a letter engraved in stone. A letter that's engraved in stone are not two separate entities that were attached. The letter is of the stone. That's how deeply attached the Jew is to Torah. It's one entity literally. You can't remove the letter once it's etched in stone. That's the... I don't mean to use the stone analogy now, but just for the concept that this... When we say... By the way, just to make sure we got the point here is not that we have this cutout paper. The letters are not part of the cutout black sheet. The letters are emanating from the white sheet, from the back. And that's what we're trying to highlight, that it's a manifestation of God. To bring home this idea, one more illustration before we continue. And we'll do it once again with a Hasidic story, because that's how they go down easiest. So, back to Rabbi Schneur Zalman, the author of the Tanya. He had a grandson who eventually became the third Chabad Rebbe, known as the Tzemach Tzedek. When this boy was about age two or three, this boy actually lost his mother and was very much raised by his grandfather. So he was once sitting on his grandfather's lap, and he was stroking his grandfather's beard. And he was saying, Zaidi, Zaidi, as he was stroking his beard. And then at some point, his grandfather said to him, that's not Zaidi, that's Zaidi's beard. So he said, okay. And he like grabbed his head. So he said, that's also not Zaidi, that's Zaidi's head. So he grabs his arm, and then his face, and then his chest. And every time he grabbed another aspect of him, he said, that's not Zaidi, that's just Zaidi's arm or leg or whatever. Okay, now this was a prodigy child who would himself become a great Rebbe later. A few minutes later, he jumped off of his grandfather's lap, and he went and he just hid behind the door, and he called out, Zaidi, Zaidi! And his grandfather says, yes, what happened? And he says, that's Zaidi. What's the difference? And this is a deep story, even though it happened to a two-year-old or a three-year-old. What's the point here? When you talk about all the body parts, those are all components of his grandfather. All part of him, but still not he himself, not his essence. You can't, an arm is very important to a person, but it's still not the person's essence. God forbid, it's even possible to live without an arm. So it's not the person's essence himself. The essence goes beyond any of these components. So similarly, when we're talking about God and these emanations, we are making the point that there is God, which is God's essence, and then there are these manifestations of God, like we had in this story. So, let me just get up to, did we already, So, just think of it this way. A garment, which we used, which we discussed a lot last week, is totally separate, right? The shirt I'm wearing today, I may or may not wear it tomorrow, but I certainly could not wear it if I don't want to. It's totally separate from the person when it comes to our garment. When it comes to an arm, it's an integral part of the person, but it's still not the essence of the person. But then you have the person themselves. Then you have me, and that's the essence. And similarly, when it comes to God, again, same idea, which we're trying to illustrate, which starting with the professor and the Newtonian idea, the two components, and this is how we're trying to illustrate and bring home these ideas of there being God, the way he's transcendent, and then there's God the way he emanates from himself within these 10 characteristics. This should be reconciling our original question and contradiction between the two sources in Jewish literature. On one hand, we find that God is totally transcendent, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he's removed, he's undefinable, but then we also find where God does have these definitions and does have these characteristics. Yet, we established that they are not separate entities in the world of Atzilut, they are God himself, and they're just emanating from him.
By the fact that we are saying that he's not definable, right? We are also saying that he's everywhere.
Correct.
That's my only point.
Correct.
At the end, that's the takeaway, right? It's because he's not specific, he's everywhere, and that should be the guy.
Yes, when we... Yes. And I'm sure we'll still be getting into that more, but when we say God is in heaven, we don't mean that he's more in heaven than on earth. It's just a way of kind of referring to God being above, kind of like we said before. Above doesn't mean that he's higher and not lower. He's everywhere. There's plenty of verses that express exactly that. In Aleinu we say, Bashamayim imal v'ala aretz mitachas. He's above, he's below. He's both. Saying that he's above in Yiddish, how do you say God, usually? Ever heard of Eibishter?
Yeah.
Eibishter means the one above. Doesn't mean he's only above and not below. It just means that he's beyond and transcendent. But he could be right in front of you and be transcendent too.
These descriptions are not limited. They don't limit God to the description. God is all of them.
All of what?
All of the attributes that he shares.
Yes, he's not one or and not another. Yes, he's all of them. The limitation is the fact that we apply these 10 and not 11. That's part of the limitation. But again, this is only where God emanates from himself. God himself is obviously beyond. Yes.
Does that relate to the three thoughts we thought about last week? The three levels. One was where we had no knowledge of what was going on. And the third one was where we had an awareness.
So this is more like the three worlds after this world that we're talking about.
Okay.
That's already where there's independence. We talked about three phases as in the growth of a child. Right? From infancy, a little bit of self-awareness, more self-awareness, and then full-on independence. So those three stages are more like the three worlds of Bria, Yetzira, Asiya that we identified last week, but those are independent of God. Over there, there's already independence. Because remember, where God withdraws, independence emerges. When God hides himself, that's when reality is able to think that we have something going for ourselves. But the world of Atzilus, there's no withdrawing at all. That's why the Alter Rebbe couldn't even finish uttering the word Atzilut or writing it, because he was so overwhelmed by the intensity of the divine presence within that realm. Now, obviously, it takes someone like him to be able to resonate with it. But that's the idea. Okay, is everyone kind of with me? Basically with me? Okay, good. So, we're going to move along here. We still have a lot to cover, but I'm going to try to condense stuff. I'm not going to dwell on this, but you can take a look in figure 2.1 on page 53. By the way, obviously, I would recommend and encourage you to spend time outside of the actual class to explore these ideas more, and there's a lot of features in the student book that you can benefit from, which we don't always have time to call attention to during the class. So in figure 2.1, you actually have the list of all 10 of these characteristics, and you also see how it corresponds to one of those that were mentioned in those two verses. We quoted two verses earlier that I believe Leah read, and you see how the 10 actually correspond to one of them from there. Okay. So now we're gonna advance a little bit more, and we're actually gonna discuss three of these 10 attributes, and we're gonna get more specific about three of them. And this is gonna be a little bit more fun, a little less abstract. I'm sure you heard this story from me before about the rabbi who was very into education, and he always promoted the necessity to educate kids in a soft way, in a warm way, and to be gentle when raising and educating children. He was big. He was very into that. Anyway, one day the synagogue got a new parking lot. They just paved a brand new parking lot. And what do you do when a new parking lot is paved in the neighborhood? What do the kids do? You come running to leave your mark, right, in history. And you put your hand down and you write your name and any other narishkeit that's going on that day. And that's what they were doing. And the rabbi comes out and sees what they're doing when they just put down the new pavement. He starts screaming at them. And his wife sees what's going on. She says, dear husband, aren't you the one that always talks about speaking gently to kids? And here you are, you're screaming at them. He said, look, I love children in the abstract, not in the concrete. So now we're going to get a little bit less abstract. We're going to talk about three of these 10 faculties, and we're going to discover how they exist both within ourselves and within God. And specifically, you could look on your map if you'd like. We're going to be talking about the three emotional attributes, namely Chesed, Gevura, and Tiferet. Chesed, Gevura, Tiferet. Let's see what those are. Anna, would you like to read for us, please? Text number 11 on page 55. It's a quote from the Tanya. Yeah.
Atzilut, which emanates from the essence of the divine infinity.
You're in text 11?
Oh, no, I skipped.
55.
Oh, wait. All right, here we go. Attributes of presence seek to provide without limit. Even if the recipient is of no need or pity, lacks nothing, and faces no difficulty, the attribute of Gevurah seeks to exercise restraint when provided to others, or to refrain from giving altogether. The attribute compassion seeks to pity whoever is in need. It is a meditating attribute between Gevurah and Chesed. For that reason, it is called Tiferet. Beauty akin is to multicolored garment that provides harmonious beauty.
Thank you. So what do we have over here? We have three attributes. The first of these three is chesed, which translates as kindness. What does kindness mean? When someone is all kind, and they are like a manifestation of kindness, then when someone gives, largely, they're not really thinking about the recipient. It's more about the giver than it is about the recipient. When you were a child, you may have been blessed to have a grandmother which always offered you food. And even if you said, I'm not hungry, I just finished lunch, what would she say? Have it anyway. Have it anyway. Abisala, what's going to happen to you? What's going on over there? When someone is behaving in a kind way like that, is she thinking about if her grandchild needs the food or not? Not even remotely. It's just about giving. Kindness means that someone is focused 100% on giving, not because the recipient needs it, but because they have to give. They have to act kind. They have to be a giver. So they're going to give. It doesn't matter what it takes. That's what kindness represents. And then you have the next attribute is gevura, which is translated as restraint or discipline. And over here, it's already a different story. When it comes to gevura, then it's more calculated giving. It's more cautious. You don't just give indiscriminately. Chesed is just to give. Now, when you give indiscriminately, sometimes you can make some serious mistakes, right? You may be wanting to give a child whatever they want, but what if they want a knife? So the right thing to do is not to give it to them. Giving indiscriminately can run into problems. Sometimes you can give somebody, as we know, there's people who, when they're given money, they may take it and spend it on certain substances that do damage to themselves. So when you're giving, you're actually not doing them a favor. You're actually doing them a disservice, but you're not thinking about them. You're just thinking about your need to give. That's kindness. When it comes to gevura, it's already more discriminate, cautious, calculated, and you think about the recipient. Does the recipient need what I'm giving them? Do they deserve what I'm giving them? Did they earn what I'm giving them? If I just give it to them and they never earned it, I'm going to be giving them the wrong impression for life. They're going to think they just get things without earning it. So I'm not going to give. So in gevura, you're already thinking about the other. Very well-known episode where we have these two things playing out. Sarah, right? Could you please read for us text number 12? It's from the Talmud. Maybe familiar to some of you. Thank you. So we'll explore that in a second. So we have chesed, kindness, and love, which is to give and to share without restraint, and it's the need of the giver. But then you have gevura, strength, which represents restraint and discipline, and calculated giving, and it's about the beneficiary. Now, when we just read this story about Shammai and Hillel, two great sages, same person approached them both, and they reacted differently. Which one of them was right?
No.
So the truth is, it's not a fair question to ask. We tend to sometimes think that, well, Hillel was the nice guy, Shammai wasn't the nice guy. But that would not be a fair reading of this story. In fact, what happened was that each one was a manifestation of a different characteristic. Hillel had a nature of kindness, and when somebody came to him and asked him to study, so he didn't even think twice. He just started to teach him. He didn't think about, is this guy serious? Is he a serious student? Am I going to be helping him if I welcome him? None of that. He just gave. When that same guy came to Shammai, Shammai was of the gevura kind. He was someone that thought about the recipient. He thought about this fellow. One second. Am I going to be doing him a favor if I just convert him and teach him the whole Torah, so to speak, on one foot? One second. What if somebody comes to, I know you're a doctor, right? What if someone comes to you and says, teach me your profession while I stand on one foot? You're going to Shammai him, right? Even though you're a nice guy. So we shouldn't call Shammai the not nice guy. The only difference is that he is thinking about, am I helping this guy or am I not? Maybe I'll actually be helping him more if I reject him and tell him this is not how we approach Judaism. You have to go reevaluate. You have to get serious and then come back to me once you have a better understanding of what you're getting into. So it's not a question of who was nice and who wasn't. It was a question of what their attitude was, and their attitude was based on their personal characteristic. What were they? A chesed guy or a gvura guy? So Hillel was a chesed guy, which is all about him. I have to give. Doesn't matter what the state, the status of the recipient is. Shammai was someone that did take into consideration the recipient. And is this fellow up to it? Am I going to be helping him? Is he deserving? All these things come into play when you are the gvura kind. Gvura is the disposition to restrain giving and sharing in order to provide only in proportion to what the recipient deserves. You don't want to do something, especially when it comes to education, a child. You don't just give them without deserving or unearned, because then they're going to get the wrong message. So you got to be careful. So here is the chesed versus the gvura. But then you have a third, and the third is tiferet. What does tiferet mean, anybody? Tiferet. Tiferet is beauty. Yeah, it's beauty. Beauty. You could also say glory. You can also say glory. What's that? That's gevura. Gevura is more judgment. You're judging the recipient if they're deserving. When you come to Tiferet, there is where you have the balance. Tiferet represents the harmony of both chesed and gevura. So the chesed guy will say, just give indiscriminately. The gevura guy may say, well, this person's not deserving, so I wouldn't give them. The tiferet is a balance between the two, and is the fusion of both of them, and a healthy balance. And what does that mean? That if there's a certain person, let's say they didn't earn that I should be giving them something, but tiferet, which represents also compassion, the compassion component may lead me to give them anyway. Not because they deserve it, they may not be deserving it, but they may be in need. And if there's a need, I may give them anyway, even though they don't deserve it. And that's actually a healthy balance. Either one of the others are kind of a little more to the extreme. And, I mean, it's not the end of the world to be one or the other. But the ideal way is to be tiferet, which has a healthy balance of both. So not that you're very exacting and very strict, and unless someone earned it all, you don't give them. Some people are like that, but that's a little bit more to the extreme. The right balance would be is even, yes, they may not deserve it. But if there's a need, then that need may arouse my compassion, and then I will give them.
Rabbi.
Yes.
I don't think that in this Hillel Shammai story, that Hillel is pure kindness. He has a balance. I see it as more tiferet, because he says, here's a line, don't do what is hateful to others or what is hateful to you. But then he also says, go and study. So he kind of brings it together.
So what we have to realize is that normally we use the term kindness, you know, we use it commonly, that this person is kind, etc., and we don't necessarily mean the way we're interpreting it here. From a pure Kabbalistic meaning, chesed means where someone is only thinking about the recipient. Now, Hillel was inclined to that direction. For the most part, he was chesed-oriented. And even here, he didn't really think about that fellow. I mean, the guy only wanted the Torah on one foot, so he only could give him one thing. He was standing on one foot. If you give him a second, it's going to be done. So he had to give him one. So he gave him one, which in his opinion was a fundamental teaching of Torah, which it was. But it was still only carrying out whatever that person... He wasn't really thinking about that person's needs. He was just giving. And that person asked for something, and he didn't think twice. That's why he's more associated with that side. And then we have the gevura, but the teferet is the middle path. Now, this is the way we discussed it. We illustrated these three things, the way they are, within a human being, within any of us, right? There's so tiferet, beauty, is harmonization and the combination of chesed and gvura, which is the ideal way to go. So that is what these three characteristics are. And remember, we chose these three out of the 10 to highlight today. Just obviously, we're short on time, so we can't discuss more than three. Now, why do we have these three? And these three exist. Why do we even have Atzilut, which includes these three characteristics? Why is it necessary? And the answer is because what we're saying is that God actually uses all these three traits in the way he relates to the world. Can anybody here identify something that they have in their life that God may have given you, even though you didn't deserve it or earn it, so to speak?
Breath.
The breath of life, right? God created us, the gift of life, and he gifts it to us every day from new. Can I say that I deserve it? That I deserve God's kindness? Maybe I do something a little bit here and there, but I can't say that I deserve God's kindness 100%.
None of my kids I don't deserve.
Now we're talking about God. So from God's perspective, we see God acting in a way of kindness, where he doesn't consider whether we earned it or are deserving or not. And I would even suggest that largely that God functions that way a lot. On the other hand, sometimes God operates with gvura and functions in a way, does this person deserve? Did they earn this, that, or the other? And of course, Tiferet, which is the blend of both of them, which is the ideal way to go, so that you're not clearly one way or the other. But even if someone doesn't deserve it, to still find a way that they should be able to receive the gift. So certainly God does the same. As we describe the way it exists within us. All right, so I want to advance to the last section because we don't have a lot of time. There is in Figure 2.2, which we're not going to read now, but we identify a lot of things there, the way they're aligned with either kindness, chesed, or gevura. We don't explain them here, but just gives you an idea how everything in the world comes from these divine attributes. So, for the last 15 minutes, we started to discover how all this is relevant to our lives, and we will appreciate it more by following a line of prayer that we recite each morning. So, if you remember at the end of last week's class, we spoke about the thought, speech, and action that we do right when we wake up. The first thought we're supposed to have is a thought about God, and that we just received the gift of a new day, and we're going to get up to serve Him. Then we speak the one-line prayer of Moda Ani, and then we wash our hands. So that's thought, speech, action. But then, after that, once you're kind of fully more ready to go, and you're washed up, so there's a prayer that we say, which we quote in text number 13. In text number 13, where are we? Joseph, could you please read the English of text 13, please?
My God, this holy place within me is pure. You created it, you formed it, you breathed it.
Thank you. So are some of these words familiar? Do they make a little more sense when we read this prayer in the Hebrew? So we say, Nishamash nasata bi tahorahi, the soul that you gave me is pure. And then we say, Ata barata, ata yitzarta, ata nefachta bi. Barata yitzarta, are those familiar? They're from last week's discussion. The world of Bria, Yitzira, and Nefachta represents Asiya, because that's how this world came to be, where God blows the soul into... Yeah, so that represents those three worlds. But before that, before we say that the soul, what we're saying is that the soul originates within God. It's pure. We're identifying it as pure. What does pure mean? Pure means that our soul that we have, that God gave us, originates in the world of Atzilut. It comes from this world. That's where it originates from a world of absolute godliness, a world of purity. But then the soul devolves, and it comes through the worlds of Berea, Yetzira, Asiya, again identified in that line, and eventually it comes into our body once it's in the world of Asiya. And that's when our life begins here on earth. And yes, every day we also return it to God when we retire for the night. We wake up in the morning. In God's kindness, we're blessed with a new day, and our soul is fully restored. So that's what this prayer means. What does this tell you? What this tells us is that every single day when we're starting our day, we're once again highlighting the fact that our soul is pure. Meaning, even if yesterday, or 2 days ago, or last year, or in my youth, at any point from when I was born up until today, my life maybe went through a certain challenge, or you think that there's certain, your soul or your experiences, that certain negative energy got stuck to you, and you feel like you can't shake it off. It may have been yesterday, it may have been years ago, and I'm not able to move past it. This prayer is telling us that the soul that we have right here and right now comes from absolute purity. And when we receive it back from God every morning, it's refreshed, right? That's what, when we give our soul back to God at night, it's, so to speak, it's, you can call it your battery recharging or whatever you want to call it. But by the time you get it back in the morning, it is totally cleansed and it's totally refreshed. And it's 100% pure, like when you got it the first time, which is a very empowering thought, because we need to remember that we should never define ourselves by any past experiences. And whatever we did experience doesn't do anything, doesn't taint our soul. Our soul remains absolutely pure as it was on day one up until today. And another thing this tells us is that our soul, because it originates from the world of Atzilut, it comes from a place that's beyond this world. Now, if you want to have a positive effect on a certain situation, it's very difficult to have that if you're of that circumstance. Like if I'm one of a certain group of people, then I'm one of them. I'm not. If I want to positively impact them, I may not be able to if I'm one of the bunch. You have to be able to come with something that they don't have. Otherwise, what do you have to contribute? If a teacher is going to come into a classroom and it's just one of the children, then they're not going to be able to teach anything to this class. Obviously, they won't be able to control the class either. But when you have a teacher who has something that the children don't, whether it's years, wisdom, hopefully both, then they're able to do so. We need to remember that we are put here on earth, and we are put here on earth and empowered with that pure soul, and that pure soul is what gives us the ability to change the world, because we have something, we're endowed with something that's not of the world, it's from above the world, and that's why we're able to have a positive impact on the world. Before we advance, I want to just play a short clip here, which is, actually on this prayer that we just read in text 13, but it's a little unique of how we're going to listen to it. So there's actually a clip going around, it was posted on Twitter, etc., of a 24-year-old Israeli by the name of Yehuda Becher, who grew up in Beitar Elite, and he recorded this video of him singing a song to these words. Now, unfortunately, he was at the music festival on October 7th, and he lost his life. Only a few days before October 7th, he recorded himself singing a song to these words. And if you'll follow the words, we don't quote it here in this text, but I want you to know what the rest of the prayer is. And you hear him saying it just a few days before that, before he finished his mission here on earth. We say, you have formed it, you have breathed it into me, and you preserve it within me. And these are the words that he sings, the next words. You will eventually take it from me and restore it within me in the time to come. And here he is. He sent this clip to a friend. You could see just from the video what kind of beautiful soul this Yehuda was. So let's hear him sing the song, and then we'll advance to the closing of the class. Catching up here. This was the pure soul, created as Bria, formed Yetzirah, breathed into me, represents Asiya. And the soul is pure, means that it originates in Atzilut.
Nishama shenatata bi Eohai Ata bevato ata yitzalta ata nefakta bi Veata meshama bekirbi Veata ati tikla mimeni Lachasira biladi davo Kol zman she'an shama bekirbi mode ani lefanecha Zman she'an shama bekirbi mode ani lefanecha Ribon kol ha-masim adon kol ha-neshamot.
You could see what kind of beautiful soul he was just from the way he sang that song so heartfelt. And Yehuda Becher.
Becher?
Yeah, Becher. So, in closing, we're going to come back to actually the original topic that we opened the class with. And that is, we were wondering, how do we identify what our mission in life is and what our calling is? So with that, we're going to come back, now that we established what these 10 powers are within God, and then we also identified them within ourselves, now we need to be able to figure out what the unique source of my soul is. Every soul which originates in the world of Atzilut, yes, it has all 10 faculties, but nonetheless, every soul has one that's more dominant than the others. Just like we said about those two sages, Hillel was more dominantly kind. Shammai was more dominantly discriminate. So every one of us, even though we have all of them, but one is more dominant than the others. So this is what should help us identify what it is. Let's do a quick exercise on page 61, exercise 2.1. You can do this very quickly to yourself. Rate yourself using the following scale, from 1 to 5, from 1 very weak, 5 very dominant, and look at these two lists to try to figure out. You can do a character
assessment.
Test or assessment, an aptitude test, to see which one you're more inclined to. Are you 1 to 5? Generous, kind, loving, extroverted, optimistic, forgiving, frugal, exacting, respectful, introverted, realistic, perfectionist. And again, don't look at one as if one's better than the other. That would be the wrong way to look at it. Both of them have advantages. But if you want to know which type of soul you have, at least as far as these two characteristics, try to identify which one you are more inclined to. If you find yourself being fives to one side or the other, then you may be inclined to chesed or gevura. If you find yourself in the middle, you may actually be a tiferet type of soul, which is a healthy balance in between the two. Text number 15, which I'll read, where we have a quote from the Talmud, a very short quote, where one sage says to the other, "Tell me, what was your father's favorite mitzvah?" Avuch b'may have zohir tfei. Now, why is one sage asking the other which mitzvah was your father's favorite? Who said he had a favorite? Why doesn't he ask him, did your father have a favorite? Instead of asking which mitzvah was his favorite. And the answer is because it actually was a given that we have a certain one that's a favorite. And that's because we all have a certain characteristic that's more dominant in our soul. And therefore, we should be drawn to one mitzvah more than other mitzvahs based on the makeup of our individual soul. So he knew that, and therefore he asked his colleague, what was your father's dominant character trait? In other words, that was his question. So what we're taught here in text 16, which I'm not going to read now, is that whatever makeup we do have, somebody may be a little more intellectual, then they should utilize these characteristics to study more and to use their mind for divine purposes. If somebody is a very loving person, they should identify opportunities to be able to do favors for other people or to embrace other people. And that doesn't mean that they don't do the other things. It just means that you have one where you're more dominant that resonates even more than the other things. And if someone has the ability to make a difference in the community, if someone has leadership skills, if somebody has certain capabilities with logistics, they can get involved in the community and help organize events, etc. There's a lot of opportunities. Now, you may have heard of a great Hasidic master by the name of Reb Zusha of Ani Poli. Anyone? Okay. Very famous. He's quoted as saying that at 120 years, when I come to heaven, I am not afraid of God asking me why you weren't as righteous as Abraham. Because to that, I'm going to have a ready answer. Because I was not Abraham. Or if he asks me, why weren't you as great as Moses? I'm going to say, because I wasn't Moses. What I am afraid of is when I'm going to be asked, why weren't you like Reb Zusha? That I'm not going to have a good answer to. Because Zusha, I have to be. I have to be the best version of Zusha. When I'm asked why I wasn't as good as Zusha, I'm not going to have a good answer to that. What it means is that God gave us individual abilities, skills, capabilities, and I think it may be Mark Twain who said that you need to be yourself because everyone else is taken already. If we try to be somebody else, then we're being somebody else, and we are squandering what we need to be. If God created Zusha to be Zusha, and I'm going to try to be like somebody else, that someone else already exists, and now all I'm achieving is that what I'm supposed to be is not going to happen. So we need to identify who we are, what resonates with us deeply more than other things, and with that, we need to figure out what our life's calling is, what our life's mission is. Now, we can do so, as we said before, by seeing what the circumstances in our life is, what our soul's drive is like, which character trait we're more inclined to. And we should run with it, identify opportunities to pursue it, and do it all the way. Because that may be why our soul was put here. I just want to clarify that it's not that God creates a soul and then says, you know what, your mission is going to be X, Y, and Z. It doesn't work that way. God has missions and create souls in order to get those missions to be done. So from our origin, we're already designed and created and brought into existence because we have a very specific purpose and mission to carry out. It's only up to us to identify what it is. Once we identify what it is, go all the way with it. And the other areas in life, by the way, doesn't mean that that's the only thing we should do. Somebody identifies a certain character trait and they run with it, but that doesn't mean that we are to neglect other areas in our character. Meaning, even though there are certain things that don't come easy to me, let's say I identify what I need to be, but then separately, maybe I'm not such a generous person, naturally, on that list. But it doesn't mean that that's how I need to stay. In the other areas in life that don't come easy to me, I also need to practice self-discipline and try to overcome my natural tendencies and to try to serve God and do good and be productive in those areas too. It's just that what my soul makeup is, for that, I need to go all the way, 100%, and everything else I also need to give attention to, and that way we will fulfill and carry out our life's mission. Let's just close with the summary video, and that will be the formal ending of the class. Let's see?
Lesson 2. The Dawn of Limitation. 1. Reminding ourselves about our Atzilut origins provides us with durable confidence, teaches us that spiritual growth is always within reach, and inspires us to change our environment for the better. 2. It is important to identify the root of our soul by closely analyzing our personality. This will guide us in identifying the mitzvah that requires our